This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media, and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org. I also buy the Back-to-Back Cafe, a worker-owned collective featuring fair trade, shade-grown, organic coffee, pastries, and vegetarian food. Back-to-Back Cafe is open Monday through Saturday and is located at 6th and East Burnside. More information at
503-233-1929. I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO, your listener-sponsored community radio station. My name is Fran Michelle and I'm your host this morning. Our engineer is Tammy Dean. The Old Mole digs deep among the hidden roots of polite society, undermining institutions of domination, bringing back stories of ordinary people like you and me who challenge established authority and build new democratic movements. Community sponsorship means that KBOO itself is a small D democratic organization, and during our membership drive, we hope that you too will dig deep in your pockets and contribute to keep the Old Mole digging by calling 503-232-8818 or going to our website, kboo.fm, and clicking Join Now. Today's show features Bill Resnick talking with Larry Kleinman of Picoon about current struggles over immigration. I'll have a well-read red segment discussing attacks on higher education, and Movie Mole's Denise Morris and I will be discussing the film All the President's Men. So stay tuned for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We go first to Bill Resnick and Larry Kleinman.
Thanks, Fran, and Larry. Larry Kleinman, welcome to KABU.
Thanks, Bill. I'm glad to join you.
Larry is one of the founders with Cipriano Farrell, Juan Mendoza, Ramon Ramirez in 1985 of Picoon, the Northwest Farm Workers Union. It's become a huge unifying force supporting farm workers and in fact, all oppressed and exploited workers in the Northwest. Very important in Oregon, but also even in national politics. Larry Kleinman, Picoon and immigrant groups right now are having there's a huge threat and perhaps a huge opportunity. There's a debate on immigration has erupted in U.S. politics. The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a very tough enforcement bill. Only that, and the Senate is debating as we speak, in fact, and will likely or could well enact something very soon. Tell us, why is immigration surprisingly now stage center? And there was also the huge rally, of course, in L.A. and across the country yesterday. Why is immigration now stage center, and what are the dueling contesting proposals?
Politics, I want to start briefly with the politics of this and refer listeners to our website, pcun.org, where we've posted a PDF copy of our latest newsletter, the update number 53, and it has an editorial in it that lays out in under 1,000 words, I think, a pretty clear analysis about why this is happening now. And the title of this editorial is Republicans' Latest Target for Repeat War. And that target is immigrants. What we've seen is, in the last 15 months, that the Bush administration and their key strategist, Karl Rove, have gone from believing that they could actually garner long-term Latino voter loyalty by pushing some kind of immigration reform that would appeal to the Latino community by offering some kind of a legalization. They've gone all the way from that point to embracing the reactionary, xenophobic, un-American, and racist wing of their party, which is proposing the enforcement-only bill that you described. It's led by Jim Sensenbrenner, a Republican from Wisconsin, and the proposal he's pushing that the House did pass is H.R. 4437. I want to mention that in passing that people, we are calling on people to call Senator Smith and Senator Wyden in D.C. today and tomorrow. We believe that they will vote with us on these proposals in the Senate, but they are hearing an avalanche of loud voices from the other side, and they need to hear from our side. And I'll give those phone numbers in a little while. Anyway, the politics of this are, as we all feel every day, that there's an immense and widespread and deep amount of failure, and people feel deep frustration about that. It starts with the Iraq War, the bungled response to Katrina, budget deficits, bribery scandals, cuts in services, and what we call the shipwreck of Social Security reform. All of that has left the Republican Party needing to change the subject. And what they have done over in history, in our analysis, is change the subject from time to time to scapegoat immigrants. Sometimes it's about a bad economy. Sometimes it's about a war where they target a particular group of immigrants. And in this case, we think it's the combination of all of that failure and the swift demographic change that immigration is itself causing. I want to come back to those a little bit later because it's surfaced some really deep divisions in the Republican Party itself, and it's causing, as the L.A. march on Saturday indicates, a huge backlash from the Latino community. On Saturday, there were 500,000 people in the streets of downtown L.A. Yeah. 3 weeks earlier, there were 100,000 people in Chicago. There have been tens of thousands in Phoenix, Denver, and other cities. And in Portland, we saw 4,000 people, according to the Associated Press, about 3 weeks ago. So the proposals that Congress is now looking at, one is the enforcement-only Sensenbrenner bill, House Resolution 4437. And it would do things like build a 700-mile wall on the southern border. It would add many more border agents, and more importantly, would federalize local law enforcement and require them to enforce immigration laws, which would basically totally decimate any kind of community policing in the immigrant community or any immigrant cooperation. It would criminalize presence in the U.S. and any assistance that anybody would give to an undocumented person. So it's a form of proto-fascism. And it would therefore create a class of what I think you could only call untouchables, people who are completely shunned, permanently shunned, and with whom any contact is a dangerous thing for the rest of society. So it's creating a class of permanent outcasts.
Right.
That's the enforcement-only proposal.
Which is really anathema to lots of particularly business Republicans, right? That whole core, the moneyed core of the party that depends on immigrant workers, that they obviously are opposed to that, right? Like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is strongly
opposed. And the growers.
Even Walmart, they're all really hotly opposed to that business.
They are, and they're very, very afraid of it because it will cut off the labor supply that they have come to depend on. In the Senate, there have been a series. There are four types of what have been loosely called guest worker proposals that have been kicked around and have been debated in the Judiciary Committee, and that's what's now coming out to the floor today and tomorrow and into the first part of April. One is what's called the report and deport idea, which is all the undocumented workers have to leave the country, and then maybe they can come back. And you know that's not going to work. People are not going to believe that. Second one is Bush's idea, which is a fixed period of time, temporary worker status, which you can gain in the U.S. by virtue of a specific job, but it only lasts a maximum of 6 years, after which you have to leave. And we all know that's not going to work. People have come here at great danger and expense and risk, and while they might accept the temporary status at the end of it, the conditions will not have fundamentally changed, and they won't leave. They'll go back underground. A third one is same idea, only with no time limit, so it's just open-ended. A model, by the way, that Europe has used over the last few decades, where workers come from other countries and are in a perpetual temporary status, and they never have any real rights or security. And the last one is the one that we...
And can be deported on almost any ground.
And can be, and are vulnerable. And the last one is the approach that we support, which is what now has been called earned legalization, meaning that you have temporary worker status, you're able to change jobs, it leads after a fixed amount of time to lawful permanent residence, which is indefinite, and which does allow you to work anywhere, go anywhere, travel, and so on, and which then puts you on the track to citizenship.
Is that the Kennedy-McCain proposal?
And Kennedy-McCain is an example of that. And so that's what's been debated. I think it's that we're optimistic that we have the votes to defeat Sensenbrenner in the Senate. Harry Reid, the Democratic leader, has announced a filibuster threat against it. I don't think the Republicans and a few Democrats that are worried about their political futures have 60 votes to overcome that. So the real danger is what will happen, what kind of so-called compromise might happen, which adopts a lot of Sensenbrenner and then some inadequate or even dangerous guest worker program.
Right. Larry, what is KBOO meant for Pekun and the other social justice organizations?
Well, I think it's hard to overestimate the importance of KBOO as our voice to an absolutely critical wing of our movement, our supporters, and people in Latino communities outside of our immediate area. So we, you know, KBOO's been centrally important to the kind of movement and the vision of movement building and the idea and the embracing of movement building that we've manifest in our communities and that we think and we see KBOO manifesting and amplifying in many, many other communities. And one other thing I'd mention is that, as some of your listeners may already know, Pekun now has just received a license to operate a low-power FM radio station, KPCN-LP. It'll be on the air in the fall. It'll only reach a few miles around the Woodburn area. But again, KBOO will be a key resource for us for how to make or to implement a powerful resource as we join the community radio movement more directly.
Well, congratulations, Larry. Congratulations on so many things. Keep up the struggle, and people will be calling Washington and adding their voice.
The well-read Red has been reading up on right-wing attacks on higher education. I don't mean the targeted assassinations of Iraqi academics reported on BrusselsTribunal.org, nor even the denials of visas to foreign scholars who've been invited to U.S. conferences or hired to teach at U.S. universities, as reported on AAUP.org. I mean something more local, what Henry Giroux a couple of months ago on DissidentVoice.org called the relentless attempt to destroy critical education as a foundation for an engaged citizenry and a vibrant democracy. Giroux points out that the attack on all levels of education is evident not only in the attempts to corporatize education, standardize curricula, privatize public schooling, and use the language of business as a model for governance, but also in the ongoing effort to weaken the power of faculty, turn full-time jobs into contractual labor, and hand over those larger educational forces in the culture to a small group of corporate interests. Public schooling is increasingly reduced to training and modeled after prisons, with its emphasis on criminalizing student behavior and its prioritizing of security over critical learning. Educators are now viewed largely as de-skilled technicians, depoliticized professionals, paramilitary forces, hawkers for corporate goods, or grant writers. Giroux doesn't mention it, but those educators who don't fit such descriptions are liable to be attacked as, well, dangerous. Last month, David Horowitz published a book called The Professors, the 101 most dangerous academics in America, listing scholars to the left of center, including luminaries like Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn. Another figure on the list, journalism professor Robert McChesney, responded last month on CommonDreams.org that if Horowitz believes that publicly supported universities have an obligation to have faculties that represent the range of U.S. political opinion, and that it currently tilts too far to the left, he should follow the logic to its obvious resting place. Generals and military officers are far more important to the functioning of government, and as history shows in depressingly frequent detail, a much greater threat to democratic governance than are, say, anthropology professors. In the United States, the military is enormous, and it's entirely funded by taxpayers, and the officer corps is significantly right-wing Republican. If Horowitz is going on some sort of rampage about getting political balance in important publicly funded professions, he can only be taken seriously if he starts at the Pentagon. When he has established how to do it there, we can proceed to the campuses. Horowitz is also the man responsible for promoting versions of what he calls an Academic Freedom Bill of Rights, a title that needs to be interpreted as we do the Clear Skies Initiative, or the liberation of Iraq. Bills allowing college students the power to sue dictator professors who offend their beliefs by teaching material which contradicts those beliefs have been proposed in several states, and Pennsylvania has a congressional board set up to investigate such cases of bias in the classroom. The satirical website Fafblog, fafblog.blogspot.com, last year put it this way. Freedom is ever marching, and its latest target for emancipation is none other than Gulag academia, where millions of students are held hostage by totalitarian educators whose cruel practice of teaching them things they don't already believe could soon be put to an end. For far too long, higher education has been concerned with education and instruction, mere euphemisms for the harsh indoctrination into the totalitarian ideology of fact. But now students will be given the tools to fight back, to free themselves of their oppressive enslavement to a world in which life evolved over millions of years through natural selection, dinosaurs weren't wiped out 6,000 years ago by the flood of Noah, and the evil Zemu was not responsible for the existence of body thetans. Will students learn more in such an environment? Of course not, but this is precisely the point. America has done so much to impose tyranny in the form of earthly despots that it can only proceed to liberate humanity from the greatest dictator of all, reality, which tyrannically insists that we acknowledge that which is rather than that which would be more convenient for us. Freed from the tyranny of reality and the dangerous threat of its advance guard, information, America's youth will be free to live in a world consisting solely of their own pre-existing beliefs, where messy ideological review and examination of fact have become unnecessary. More seriously, and more recently, Sophia McLennan last week on Counterpunch noted that, although these attacks have typically been disguised as a defense of student rights, really the assault is on the student. The right now claims that students are victims of indoctrination. Brainwashing and mind control in the classrooms constitute a parent's worst fears, and the idea immediately makes the public suspicious of professors. But let's consider for a moment what such charges presume, especially when they are bundled with the claim that students need more access to conservative faculty. Throughout the Bush reign, the public has been repeatedly asked to critically believe, uncritically believe, to have blind faith, to sacrifice, and to obey. The connections between the type of public ideally imagined by the administration and the nation's youth should be obvious. If you require an obedient populace, then it's essential that you begin training the youth accordingly. Favoring tests over critique, memorization over engagement, loyalty over social commitment, individualism over community, and so on, implies a student educated to passively consume what the government provides, rather than to actively participate in the construction of a democratic society. This negative view of the unthinking student repeatedly appears in arguments that assume that students are docile and submissive, easily persuaded to accept their professor's politics. The right also confuses the necessary confrontations that arise in the atmosphere of critical pedagogy with hostility toward student views. What really worries the right, McLennan argues, is not left-leaning faculty, but the intellectually sophisticated students such faculty hope to encourage. She concludes, as education becomes increasingly privatized and students increasingly consider education as a consumer product, it will become more and more difficult to encourage students to use the university as a site of social engagement and collective critique. On the positive side, the greatest advantage the left may have in this battle is its respect for the student. Fostering wakefulness over dreams, engagement over loyalty, vigilance over obedience, political activism over passive consumption, and hope over fearfulness may well be our best weapon. For the well-read read, this has been Fran Michel. Good morning. This is Fran Michel here to discuss with Denise Morris to discuss All the President's Men, which is going to be playing at the Hollywood Theater starting April 14th. And is also available on DVD at independent video rental outlets around town and through the Multnomah County Library. The 1976 film stars Dustin Hoffman and Robert Redford as Washington Post reporters Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward, and it follows their 1972 reporting on the break-in at the Democratic National headquarters at the Watergate complex and their investigations that trace the event back to the Republican White House. The film ends with a series of teletype headlines sketching out the resulting events that ultimately led to President Richard Nixon's resignation in 1974 in the face of his impending impeachment. The Hollywood Theater program notes point to the film's timeliness in relation to current scandals about illegal wiretapping. Nixon ordered illegal surveillance of anti-Vietnam War groups and political rivals and argued unsuccessfully that he was justified by the interests of national security. But in response, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, or FISA, provided for government warrants in cases of actual national security concerns. The current inhabitant of the White House, of course, has ignored the FISA court and argued that he does not need it sanctioned for surveillance in the interests of national security. Another timely aspect of the film, pointed out by Robert Redford on the DVD commentary track, is the question of the past and present state of news media and the possibilities of investigative journalism.
Great possibilities, but shrinking resources, and there's a lot of great research that could be done. The film will be playing at the Hollywood Theater, I believe it's April 14th it starts, so everybody can kind of dig back in for a refresher course, or for the new generation that might not have seen All the President's Men, could do some looking at the state of journalism today. There's a couple great articles. Stateofthenewsmedia.com is one place to go, truthdig.com, and Fran, you also found a good article that looks at Watergate on journalism.org. So there's lots of info out there and lots of debate still.
Yeah, the Columbia School of Journalism recently came out with their yearly report on the state of journalism in the U.S., and they found that, once again, resources are shrinking. Newsrooms are doing less and less of actual investigative reporting. Instead, now there tends to be reporting on the progress of the government investigation. But in fact, it's not clear that the government investigation would really have pursued events in the Watergate case if it had not been for the reporting of Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward, who were outsiders, who were beginning reporters, who were inexperienced, who were not the central figures. There's a moment in the film where one of the editors suggests, well, maybe we should get the more experienced political guys on this instead of our metropolitan staff. And it seems like it's really because they're outsiders, because they're not beholden to the politicians that they're investigating, that they're able to do this. I mean, we can think of the contrast of Bob Woodward's current career, where he is now, I mean, he hangs out with President George W. Bush. He writes books in supporting his programs because he's now, you know, he doesn't want to lose that access. And reporters who are really embedded in that system don't want to lose their access. And the more reporters who are dependent on that, and the fewer reporters there are, the more they are dependent on their government sources, their official sources, and are not able to do the kind of really tough investigation that broke open this case, and that led to people rising up and insisting that their leaders, who, I mean, Congress was not particularly eager to impeach the president initially, as at present, I mean, the people are out ahead on this question, if they have the information.
Right, exactly. And the film is interesting because when it was released, there was actually a lot of difficulty to get the film made. It's not it's framed as kind of a mystery, a murder mystery almost, with that convention. It has no real soundtrack. There's one section where there's a piece of music, but mostly the noise, the sounds are ambient. The intrigue and the paranoia and the uncertainties are kind of they're underwhelming if you think of our most current action films. But what the film did was gave people a window into what it was like for these two young reporters to go about unraveling what became an enormous issue in Washington. And what they did was, They used typewriters, they had notepads and made phone calls and they went to people's houses, and this is what we see them do. There's no internet, they go through papers, they go through books. I mean, it's seemed daunting actually watching it now, but
back in the dark ages of journalistic technology.
Exactly.
Dial phones.
That is what makes this such a great film, and now we look back on it almost seems like a period piece in the way that Goodnight, Good Luck sort of goes back and tells the story of Murrow's challenge to McCarthy, but it was made just 2 years after, and it came out up against films like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and I might mention one of my favorites, Bad News Bears, and that was the film I went to see, but It did very well. And it was like a film like Caché that's recently come out that is very understated, that deals with certain kinds of mysteries and paranoias and threats and surveillance, is also downplays the kind of over-the-top boogeyman element that we begin to understand that these guys are become entrenched in something that is much larger, but we get to watch them kind of try to unravel it and go in one direction and maybe find that it's a bit of a dead end where there may be a connection there, but it's really about this other thing over here, and then it just peels away the layers and the revelations. And
yeah, we really get a sense of journalism as labor, and we really get a sense of how much work it was. There's an amazing shot of them. They're going through book checkout slips at the Library of Congress to see what books have been taken out by whom. And, you know, this enormous, enormous stack of little teeny pieces of paper that they're going through. And the camera pulls back and back and back until it's up at the top of the rotunda in the Library of Congress. And you get a sense, there are a number of shots like this in the film, where you get a sense of how tiny they are in the face of this enormous government system in the face of this enormous bureaucracy, and yet they really are able to make a difference. It really is something that changes people's understanding of what's going on in the world, and it's also something that really transcends party lines, although there are a number of moments in the film that are kind of humorous about that.
The questions about loyalty to party, I mean, there's so much that resonates. You know, you have characters who, on the one hand, stay particularly loyal, and you also get the idea that people have been gotten to. They're not willing to risk their lives, their families, their careers, in the interest of a greater good. Then you have other people who just say, you know, this is crazy, and I've been a Republican all my life, and you find out, well, that's not really going to take us anywhere. But there are also questions of ethics and how you go about getting information, protecting sources, which we see Bob Woodward being involved in the Valerie Plame scandal of recent times. Finds himself entrenched, and in the film, actually, his life was a Republican, so he is able to, become over his career more and more entrenched in that power structure that you described earlier, and was no longer the journalist cub. Do they call them cub reporters? Or
he had been on the Washington Post 9 months at the time that he started working on this story.
Right.
So, which is, you know, he was not an old hand at that point.
Right, and he's paired with a much more savvy character in Carl Bernstein, who's played by Dustin Hoffman with his Barbarino haircut that flows around in the office. But it is really great. It has the film is made as an entertainment, and we all knew what the end was. We knew what the story was, but we didn't know how it had really evolved, and I think you know, looking at it as both a film and almost a docudrama in the way that it has this very understated character about it, but there's enough intrigue and enough interest and Hollywood filmness about it that it's interesting, and it's a good film, and it will be very important to support the Hollywood theater. They often bring us these kinds of films. Network is another one we might expect to see coming at us soon.
Yeah, it's a wonderful film. It won a number of Academy Awards, but don't hold that against it. It really is great. I mean, we have the sense of the brightly lit newsroom showing us, bringing to light the things that are otherwise hidden in the dark recesses of power. And also, KABU is a place that brings to light things that might not otherwise be visible, that you might not hear about on mainstream, increasingly consolidated media sources. And so please call and please support KABU, and we're going to go back now to Pledge Central.
Let's do it. That's us, the seedy underbelly of the media scene. Yep, that's KABU, all right. Call us now, 503-232-8818, 503-232-8818, or 1-877-500-5266. You need to make that call right now. Help us keep on bringing dirt to your ears from the what comes crawling out when you tip the rocks up and have a look underneath. There's a lot going on right now. This really is, you said it before, we'll say it again. This is an exciting time to be alive. This is an exciting place to be. And this is the best chance, the best shot you'll ever have at effecting positive change for yourself, your own community, and your society. Call us now, 503-232-8818 or 1-877-500-5266 if you're outside the 503 area code. Whatever you do, make sure that you make that call. It's important to stand up, be counted, live without fear. That's what KBOO's all about. This is a radio station that does not shy away from, dare I say the S word, sedition. We'll say a lot of things. We'll question a lot of ideas that we are expected to accept and that a great many other media outlets simply put out over the air without checking, without questioning, without in many ways thinking about at all. It's simply noise that goes out over the air. We question everything, and we dare to say some things that might not please the powers that be. But that's because we made a decision to live without fear. Call us right now. You want to be part of a fearless new world? 503-232-8818.
We would like to thank Sean, a new member, Clayton, who renewed, Karen, a new member, and Alice, who renewed, from Portland and St. Helens. Thank you very, very much. Please, please, please add your voice to the mix. We need you. Call us right now at 503-232-8818, 1-877-5266, or for our friends online, www.kboofm.
This is Bill Resnick here from the Air Room. I think I represent all the old moles, thanking so much the people who have called during the show up to now, and really asking people, those who have not called, those people who listen to us, those people who support KBOO, to reflect on what KBOO means to you, what KBOO means to this community. Even if you're an early convert to KBOO, even if you don't listen all the time, we really invite you to come down here to learn about us, to, in fact, become a radio activist. That's at 503-232-8818. On today's show, just since 7:30, you've heard from Manning Marable, a spectacularly powerful thinker on Cecil and Celeste's show, talk radio show. On the Old Mole, you've heard from Larry Kleiman of Pecoon on the current immigration debate. A wonderful interview, really cogent, laid it all out, and also, in fact, talked about the possibilities within this debate for movements to take it much further. We heard about All the President's Men, how when the people lead, the leaders follow. In fact, presidents can be forced to resign when the people decide that it's time for them to go. And we heard in the well-read red on tax on higher education. It's invaluable work that KBOO does. It really is stimulating and thoughtful. It doesn't only expose the underbelly. It also talks about the tremendous possibilities in today's United States. That's on KBOO. We really want you to call up and 503-232-8818. Please call us now and become a member and ask the people who are ready to answer about how you can become active in KBOO or how you can do more. Pledge Central, why don't you folks take it from here?
I want to just remind everyone who's listening what a real treasure Bill Resnick is. Think about how the programs that Bill has brought you over the years. Think about what the Old Mole does every week, the research that goes into it. And more than the research, the commitment and the care for community building, change, resistance, active resistance, and all the things that he has probably brought to your attention. Maybe you will follow some of those rabbit holes and see where they lead, and become engaged and actively participating in your community. Bill Resnick is someone who you will not, I guarantee you'll never hear it on other types of media outlets. Call us right now. If you value this programming and you consider it an important part of your life and your personal sort of evolution and your resistance, 503-232-8818 or 1-877-500-5266. Show your support. Become a member. It feels better to be on the inside than on the outside sometimes. I'm going to suggest to you that this is one of those times when being a member of something, being a part of this experiment, this is a wonderful experiment in resistance. It feels better to be part of it than to be outside. But we welcome everyone, and we want you to become a member of KBOO right now. 503-232-8818 or
1-877-500-5266. Let's make those phones light up. We need you.
Fran Michelle for the Old Mole. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting KBOO. Thank you, Larry Kleinman, Bill Resnick, Denise Morris. Thank you, Tammy Dean, for engineering. Thanks to the good people at Pledge Central, and thanks to all of the listeners who support KBOO. This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour.